Hello, Sun Sounds listeners. This is Michael Shannon, your volunteer reader. I'm going to read the major news articles from the Monday, March 3rd, 2025 edition of Tucson's Arizona Daily Star. Before we begin with the headline articles, let's find out what kind of weather is in store for us. Today's weather, sun and clouds mixed, highs to 61 degrees Fahrenheit, winds west at 15 to 25 miles per hour, higher wind gusts possible. Tonight's forecast, some clouds this evening will give way to mainly clear skies overnight. Lows to 39 degrees Fahrenheit, winds south-southwest at 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tomorrow's forecast predicts sunny, highs to 69 degrees Fahrenheit, south-south winds shifting to northwest at 10 to 15 miles per hour. We'll begin with a reading of the first article on the Arizona Daily Star front page titled, UK's Starmer says Europe is at crossroads in history as leaders agree to steps to Ukraine peace. This article was written by Brian Melly and Emma Burrows of the Associated Press. Dateline London. British Prime Minister Keir Starmer rallied his European counterparts Sunday to shore up their borders and throw their full weight behind Ukraine as he announced outlines of a plan to end Russia's war. Every nation must contribute to that in the best way that it can, bringing different capabilities and support to the table, but all taking responsibility to act, all stepping up their own share of the burden, he said. Starmer's exhortation to 18 fellow leaders that they need to do the heavy lifting for their own security comes 2 days after U.S. backing of Ukraine appeared in jeopardy when President Donald Trump lashed out at Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky and said he wasn't grateful enough for America's support. The meeting was overshadowed by the extraordinary scolding that took place on live television at the White House. Starmer used the opportunity as part of his broader effort to bridge the gap between Europe and the U.S. and also salvage what had seemed like a start of a peace process before Friday's spat. Starmer said he worked with France and Ukraine on a plan to end the war and that the group of leaders, mostly from Europe, had agreed on 4 things. The steps towards peace would keep aid flowing to Kyiv and maintain the economic pressure on Russia to strengthen Ukraine's hand. Make sure Ukraine is at the bargaining table and any peace deal must ensure its sovereignty and security. And continue to arm Ukraine to deter future invasion. Finally, Starmer said they would develop a coalition of the willing to defend Ukraine and guarantee the peace. Not every nation will feel able to contribute, but that can't mean that we sit back, he said. Instead, those willing will intensify planning now with real urgency. The UK is prepared to back this with boots on the ground and planes in the air together with others. He said any plan would require strong U.S. backing. He did not specify what that meant, though he told the BBC before the summit that there were intense discussions to get a security guarantee from the U.S. If there is to be a deal, if there is to be a stopping of the fighting, then that agreement has to be defended because the worst of all outcomes is that there is a temporary pause and then Russian President Vladimir Putin comes again, Starmer said. Starmer said he will later bring a more formal plan to the U.S. and work with Trump. Europe has been anxious since Trump initiated direct peace talks with Putin, who had been isolated by most Western leaders since invading Ukraine 3 years ago. The scramble to remain relevant and protect European interests as their once stalwart ally appeared to be cozying up to Putin was even more troubling when Trump called Zelensky a dictator and falsely said Ukraine started the war. Meetings last week provided some hope until Zelensky's trip to the White House on Friday. Visits to the Oval Office by Starmer and French President Emmanuel Macron, who declared his visit a turning point, were seen as steps in the right direction. The meetings were cordial and Trump even took a gentler tone toward Ukraine, though he would not commit to providing U.S. security guarantees and maintained that Europe would need to provide peacekeeping troops. Within 12 hours of Starmer's return from Washington, the talk of peace seemed to collapse as Trump and Vice President J.D. Vance berated Zelensky for challenging Trump's assertion that Putin could be trusted. During his Sunday news conference, Starmer rejected the suggestion that the U.S. was no longer a reliable ally. There are no two countries as closely aligned as our two countries in our defense. Our security and intelligence is intertwined in a way no two other countries are. So it's an important and reliable ally for us, he said. Starmer told the BBC before the summit that he does not trust Russian President Vladimir Putin, but does trust Trump. Italian Premier Giorgia Meloni said she was sorry for what happened with Zelensky in Washington. Meloni is both a strong Ukraine supporter and, as head of a far-right party, she is a natural ally of Trump. She was the only European leader to attend his inauguration. She told reporters following the meeting that Europe must remain focused on its common goals and that dividing the West would be disastrous for everyone. We need to work to reinforce our unity, and I think that Italy can play a role, not just in its own interest, but in everyone's, she said. I don't want to take any other scenario into consideration. Starmer hosted the meeting at Lancaster House, a 200-year-old mansion near Buckingham Palace, following his charm offensive with Macron to persuade Trump to put Ukraine at the center of negotiations and tilt his allegiances towards Europe. Leaders from Germany, Denmark, Italy, Netherlands, Norway, Poland, Spain, Canada, Finland, Sweden, the Czech Republic, and Romania were at the summit. The Turkish Foreign Minister and NATO's Secretary General and the Presidents of the European Commission and European Council were also in attendance. Starmer used sweeping terms to describe the challenges ahead, saying Europe was at a crossroads in its history and needed to step up to meet the once-in-a-generation moment. European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen emerged from the meeting and said she would present a plan to rearm Europe to bolster the bloc's security after a long period of underinvestment. As for the future of war-torn Ukraine, von der Leyen said it needs security guarantees. We have to put Ukraine in a position of strength so that it has the means to fortify itself and to protect itself, von der Leyen said. It's basically turning Ukraine into a steel porcupine that is indigestible for potential invaders. Our next front page article is titled, Despite $1 billion tax cuts more sought in Arizona. This article was written by Bob Christie of Capital Media Services, Dateline Phoenix. Republicans who control the Arizona legislature are looking to enact more tax cuts just 4 years after the largest tax cut in state history turned state finances on their head and a $1.8 billion surplus into a deficit nearing half that size. With the deficit now mainly gone and the state with a small surplus for the coming year after having to cut more than $1 billion to balance the current year's budget, Democratic Governor Katie Hobbs says she's willing to negotiate on tax relief measures. What she's not interested in doing is signing off on one big cut passed by the Senate last week that would automatically cut income tax rates any time the state has a structural surplus. Those cuts would essentially be locked because while cutting taxes takes only a majority vote, lawmakers must approve increases by a two-thirds vote. I'm not interested in tying our hands like that, no, she said Friday of the proposal that is similar to a Colorado system known as Tabor. Not like Tabor, no, that's not tax relief. She is tying the hands of future administrations. Tabor, or Colorado's Taxpayer Bill of Rights, was enacted by that state's voters in 1992. It limits growth to spending by state and local governments, including schools, and requires voters to okay any tax increases. The current Arizona proposal, dubbed Tabor Lite, only affects state income taxes, 18% of which is shared with cities and towns. Under the plan, the legislature's budget analysts would do an annual calculation. If there is a structural surplus, meaning more money than needed for ongoing programs, trigger the automatic cut in income tax rates for the next year. Hobbs may not have a say in the matter, though. That's because the proposal by Senator J.D. Mesnard is accompanied by a companion piece of legislation that would go right to the voters for approval if the House goes along with the Senate and approves it. That increases the pressure on Hobbs to accept something or have voters who tend to vote for measures cutting their own taxes do it on their own. The proposal from Mesnard, Republican of Chandler, involves some math. It starts with a 2.5% flat income tax rate enacted under former Governor Doug Ducey in 2021. Then there would be the calculation each year when the state collects more money than it is set to spend. Into that would be factored annual adjustments for inflation and population growth. All that would lead to a figure of how many millions of dollars of extra money is being generated. Then half of that would be used to cut the tax rate from that current 2.5%. What alarms some is that this would be a one-way ratchet. Once the rate drops, it would not go back up even in lean years unless lawmakers gathered the necessary two-thirds vote. That's something that is considered politically impossible in the legislature. Democratic senators said during hearings on SB 1318 and the accompanying ballot referral SCR 1014 that automatic income tax cuts would tie the hands of future legislators and governors when they negotiate on future budgets. What we're trying to do here is handcuff us so that we can't make decisions during a budget negotiation, Senator Brian Fernandez, Democrat of Yuma, said during the February 10th committee hearing on the measures. So handcuff is an interesting choice of words, Mesnott responded. We can put parameters on ourselves, he said. The voters put parameters on increasing taxes back in the 90s and also more recently when they're on the ballot. That refers to the need for a two-thirds margin for legislative tax hikes. An initiative to increase taxes would have to pass by a 60% margin to take effect under a measure voters approved in 2022. This is a proposal to essentially strike a balance, Mesnard said. When you have a surplus, let's split it between giving money to taxpayers and the other half allocating towards whatever you want. Fernandez said it is more than just a proposal. It's a limit on the ability of the legislature and governor to have the money needed to address important issues. It's putting parameters in the future of our state on what we can do in the next 30, 40, 50 years as a state in terms of being able to invest in education, invest in breaks for companies that come here. Fernandez said, there is a whole host of things that we could be doing as a state that would actually move us to a state further than I think restricting this kind of revenue would stop us from doing. If the House approves the tax law changes in Mesnard's HB 1318, it would take effect in the 2026 tax year. The legislators' budget analysts expect it to reduce the current 2.5 flat tax rate to 2.42%, cutting $175 million in tax revenue, half the expected $350 million structural surplus in the 2027 fiscal year. If Hobbs rejects that and the companion ballot referral, SCR 1014, is approved by voters next year, it would lead to a tax rate cut to 2.39% based on half the expected 2029 budget year surplus, leading to a $291 million in tax cuts. The current budget is just over $16 billion, with nearly half funding K-12 schools. The next highest spending goes to the state's Medicaid insurance plan for low-income residents, then prisons, human services, universities, and child safety. Mesnard has two other tax cut bills on the table. One was originally crafted to eliminate all income taxes on pensions and withdrawals from 401ks, Roth and other retirement accounts for anyone over the age 59.5, and allow tax deductions for contributions to individual retirement plans known as IRAs. It had two limits and was expected to cut more than $913 million in state revenue. Mesnard tweaked the plan to eliminate withdrawals from Roth plans, raised the age limit to 67, and set a cap on tax deductions at the standard federal deduction, now $14,600 for an individual and $29,200 for married couples filing together. The idea behind this is to try incentivizing savings, Mesnard said. We want to treat all retirement income like we do Social Security. Arizona does not assess an income tax on Social Security. Fernandez also had some thoughts on this Mesnard plan. So last week we had Tabor Light, which would cut our tax rate after a couple of years' surpluses, Hernandez said. And now you want to cut between $300 million and $900 million a year. I really like you, and respectfully, I just don't know where you think you're going to get this money. He continued, I appreciate that you want to cut the size of state government. I get that. But I just think our state has certain obligations, and these kinds of things will not let us meet them. Senator Mitzi Epstein, Democrat of Temple, said Finance Committee Mesnard chairs should be renamed the More Money You Have, the More Tax Breaks You Get Committee. That drew a rebuke from Mesnard. He said he didn't expect Democratic support, but that is because it is capped at the standard deduction amount, and lower-income Arizonans would end up paying no taxes on retirement income, while those earning more would still have to pay. He thought they'd understand it was not targeted to benefit the wealthy. The idea that the more money you make, the bigger your tax break is absolutely ridiculous, Mesnard said of the SB 1371, which awaits a Senate vote. Another Mesnard tax cut bill, SB 1331, would eliminate capital gains taxes, costing the state between $40 million and $60 million a year, according to the legislators' budget analysts. It passed the Senate on a 17-12 vote last week, and now heads to the House for consideration. The House also passed a tax cut last week, a measure by Representative Justin Olson, Republican of Mesa, which would spread $200 million in tax cuts across sales, property, and income tax. I think that every session we're down there here, we should evaluate how much of the tax relief package we can return to the taxpayers, the hardworking Arizonans, Olson said. Representative Nancy Gutierrez, Democrat of Tucson, said she was concerned about any more tax cuts in Arizona. It is extremely difficult to raise taxes in Arizona, and we already lowered many, many taxes, Gutierrez said. She noted that Olson's HB 2918 was opposed by cities and towns that would absorb some of the cuts by groups like Save Our Schools Arizona and the Arizona Center for Economic Progress, which advocates for fairer tax codes and investment in things like education, affordable housing, and health care. We have a budget crisis, Gutierrez said. We have to make money to spend it. This will further reduce what we make in our state. Olson noted that the state doesn't make money. This is not a state government's money, he said. This is the hardworking Arizona's money, and this is leaving more of their hardworking resources with them. He called this measure a placeholder tax cut that will go into the state budget conversation, as is the case with virtually all revenue unspending bills. Our next article is titled, Former Public Workers Get Payments. This article was written by Fatima Hussein of the Associated Press, Dateline, Washington. More than 3.2 million Social Security recipients who received pensions from their time as teachers, firefighters, police officers, and other public service jobs soon will see a boost in their benefits. Most people will receive their one-time retroactive payment by the end of March, and new monthly payments will begin in April, the agency says. The Social Security Administration announced it would immediately begin processing retroactive payments and will send increased monthly payments to people affected by the windfall, elimination provision, and government pension offset, which were rescinded in the bipartisan Social Security Fairness Act that President Joe Biden signed last year. The windfall elimination provision and the government pension offset limited Social Security benefits for recipients if they got retirement payments from other sources, including public retirement programs from a state or local government. Advocates say the Social Security Fairness Act rights a decades-old disparity, though it also puts a strain on Social Security trust funds, which face a looming insolvency crisis. The annual Social Security and Medicare Trustees report released last May said the program's trust fund will be unable to pay full benefits beginning in 2035. The new law will hasten the program's insolvency date by about half a year. The Social Security's aggressive schedule to start issuing retroactive payments in February and increase monthly benefit payments beginning in April supports President Donald Trump's priority to implement the Social Security Fairness Act as quickly as possible, said Lee Dudek, acting commissioner of Social Security, in a statement. The American people deserve to get their due benefits as quickly as possible. Beneficiaries from the new law include teachers, firefighters, and police officers across the country, and people whose work was covered by a foreign Social Security system. Most people will receive their one-time retroactive payment by the end of March, and new monthly payments will begin in April, which will be deposited in their bank account on record with Social Security, according to a statement from the Social Security Administration. The Congressional Research Service estimated that in December 2023, there were 747,679 people, about 1% of all Social Security beneficiaries, who had their benefits reduced by the government pension offset. About 2.1 million people, or about 3% of all beneficiaries, were affected by the windfall elimination provision. SSA asked beneficiaries to wait until April to inquire about their status of their retroactive payment, since some payments will process incrementally into March. The future of Social Security is a top political issue and has a major point of contention in the 2024 election. About 72.5 million people, including retirees, disabled people, and children, receive Social Security benefits. Now we'll pause the broadcast reading for a reminder that you are listening to a broadcast reading of the Arizona Daily Star from Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Michael Shannon, and I am a volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. If you missed any part of this program, you can access it on demand anytime on our website, www.sunsounds.org, from the broadcast info and audio link. Sun Sounds is also available on your smart home device. Now we'll turn the page to the Tucson and Region section of the Arizona Daily Star for several important and informative articles. The first article is titled, Arizona House Okays Asking for a Vote on Firing Squad. This article was written by Bob Christie of Capital Media Services, Dateline Phoenix. Arizona voters are a step closer to being asked to decide if inmates sentenced to death are executed by the current lethal injection method or will instead face a firing squad. The State House has given initial approval to a change suggested by a consultant hired by Governor Katie Hobbs, who reviewed issues the state has had with lethal injection but was fired by Hobbs before completing his report. If formally approved by lawmakers in both the Republican-controlled House and Senate, the measure would ask voters next year to change the Constitution to specify the use of firing squads over the use of drugs, the method they approved in 1992. The move wouldn't take effect on any executions before then, including that of Aaron Gunches, who is said to be put to death on March 19th. Gunches, who pleaded guilty to killing his girlfriend's ex-husband in Mesa 2002, waived additional appeals and asked to be executed. Representative Alexander Kolodin, a Republican of Scottsdale, sponsor of the measure, HCR 2024, cited the suggestion of retired federal magistrate Judge David Duncan, the expert Hobbs had hired in 2023, to review how death penalty is carried out in Arizona. Duncan suggested that switching to a firing squad would be a more humane way of carrying out execution, a view held by others. Those include U.S. Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor, appointed to the High Court by former President Barack Obama, who wrote in 2017 that firing squads negate the problem sometimes associated with lethal injections because they contain a certain quick death. In addition to being near instant, death by shooting may also be comparatively painless, she wrote in the dissent in a case where a prisoner sought that method rather than lethal injection. Kolodin said during the House debate that the Democratic governor should have listened to Duncan, her hand-picked expert, but instead of taking his advice seriously and asking his body to run a bill to switch our state's method of execution to the firing squad, as a taxpayer-funded independent analysis suggested we should do, she instead chose to fire that independent expert, Kolodin said. Well, I for one believe the expert's analysis should be taken seriously. He said using a firing squad has several advantages over the state's current method. Those include being far cheaper because it would prompt fewer legal challenges and because bullets are far less expensive than the drugs the state must search to find and buy. Major drugs manufacturers refuse to sell their products for use in executions. It is also quicker and has a low failure rate and is by far the most humane and expeditious way to dispatch the condemned, Kolodin said. Wednesday's debate on how best to kill a condemned prisoner came minutes after the House had debated a GOP-sponsored proposal increasing regulations on the use of drugs that include abortions. The move came despite a new voter-approved amendment enshrining the right to abortion in the state constitution. The stark contrast drew the attention of Representative Nancy Gutierrez, Democrat of Tucson, who called out majority Republicans for the contradiction. "I find it interesting that we just got done a few bills ago hearing about the sanctity of life and that we believe in life. We are here for life. Thou shalt not kill," she said. "And then the same party is putting up a bill to use a firing squad to kill people. It makes absolutely no sense. It would be an embarrassment for Arizona." She called the measure a waste of time that would be better spent dealing with issues such as health care, affordable housing, and school safety. Responding to Gutierrez, Representative Nick Cupper, Republican of Surprise, said he opposes both abortion and the death penalty, but still backs Culloden's proposal. "I don't believe that if I'm going to be pro-life, I can be pro-death in that regard," Cupper said. "However, to the point of this bill, the people of Arizona decided that we should have a death penalty. A firing squad is a much more humane way, and I think we should do things in the most humane way we can." Prompted by a question from fellow Republicans, Culloden noted that lethal injections are much more expensive than a firing squad. "The last time the state ordered lethal injection drugs, it spent $1.5 million to buy enough for multiple executions, although the shelf life is unknown." And while Culloden's measure does not detail firing squad rules, he said they generally have between 5 and 8 members, each firing a rifle whose ammunition costs between 50 cents and a dollar per bullet. "So we know that it is a fairly inexpensive method compared to lethal injection," he said. Hobbs hired Duncan as a special death penalty commissioner shortly after she took office in January 2023 and issued an executive order directing a review of previous problems with Arizona executions and suggestions on how to avoid them in the future. Attorney General Chris May is also a Democrat, formally paused all executions while Duncan conducted his review. In an interview shortly after he was dismissed by Hobbs last November, Duncan told Capital Media Services that he determined there was no humane way to kill someone using lethal injection. "She asked me to find out what went wrong with the previous injections that resulted in perceptions widely held that they were botched," Duncan said, "including whether lethal injections can be safely used." He said it appeared the governor did not want to hear that message. Arizona halted executions for 8 years after it took inmate Joseph Wood nearly 2 hours and repeated injections of a 2-drug cocktail to die in July 2014. When they resumed in 2022, the year before Hobbs took office, the state had moved to a single drug method using pentobarbital. 3 men were executed in 2022. What Duncan said he found is that lethal injections are far from being humane, as was promoted when lethal injections were authorized by voters in 1992. That is now the default method, although those sentenced before that date can choose to die in the state's gas chamber. Shortly after Duncan was fired, Hobbs announced that the state was now prepared to restart executions using lethal drugs under new protocols developed by the Department of Corrections, Rehabilitation, and Reentry. May then sought and received a warrant from the Arizona Supreme Court to proceed with executions of gunshots. Several states have added the firing squad as an approved execution method in recent years, often prompted by issues with obtaining the needed drugs or concerns over their effectiveness. The South Carolina man is set to become the first person to die by firing squad in the U.S. in 15 years under a new state law giving prisoners the choice of lethal injection, a firing squad, or the electric chair, according to the Associated Press. Brad Sigmund, 67, will be executed on March 7th for the 2001 baseball bat-beating death of his ex-girlfriend's parents. The measure backed by Culloden awaits a formal House vote before it moves to the Senate for consideration. If approved there, it will go on to the November 2026 ballot with no action needed by Hobbs. The next article from the Tucson and Region section of the Arizona Daily Star is titled "Complaint Changes How School Districts' Novels Are Chosen." This article was written by Madeline Parrish of the Arizona Republic. Matthew Boy began the final quarter of the 2023-24 school year by assigning an individual reading project just as he had the previous 4 years. Students in his 11th grade English class at Williams Field High School in Gilbert could choose from 5 books. The Hate U Give by Angie Thomas, The Perks of Being a Wallflower by Stephen Chbosky, It's Kind of a Funny Story by Ned Vizzini, 19 Minutes by Jody Picoult, and Paper Towns by John Green. Permission slips with summaries of the books went home to families and students and their guardians who allowed to suggest an alternate title. Nearly all of Boyle's 140 students returned the permission slip with a book selected, but the grandparents of one student took issue with the list. Bob Parrish brought his concerns to the Higley Unified School District's elected leaders. In May, during the public comment portion of a governing board meeting, he read a passage from 19 Minutes that describes a sexual act between two characters. "Introducing this into our schools only exacerbates the moral decline of our youth," Parrish said. Parrish's granddaughter remained in the class and chose an alternate novel. "She really liked him as a teacher," Kelly Parrish, Bob's wife, said of Boy. But the Parrishes complained to district administrators and ultimately to the Arizona State Board of Education about the 5 books suggested for the assignment. "It really infuriates us. Let's save a little innocence here," Kelly Parrish said. "Well, they're thinking that all the kids have deviant minds. Well, they don't, and it's just not right." Higley Unified placed Boy on paid leave for 7 school days, he said. The district investigated but found no wrongdoing. Parents of the 12 students in Boy's class who chose 19 minutes were called multiple times to make sure they still gave permission for their child to read the book, which they all did, Boy said. 19 Minutes About a School Shooting was the book most commonly banned from the U.S. public schools during the 2023-24 school year, according to the nonprofit PEN America. Higley Unified spokesperson Jessica Batista said the district followed all district and state policies and procedures regarding the complaint against Boy, and its inquiry resulted in no findings. Boy did not find out that the State Board of Education had cleared him in its investigation until the fall, he said. During the May board meeting, Bob Parrish acknowledged that Boy's assignment had required a guardian signature, but he said it had no content warning for any of the novels. "If there was a warning stating the book contained sexually explicit material, obscenities, drug and alcohol use, sexual acts, masturbation, suicide, abortion, and police racism and brutality, those are all reviews from the internet on these 5 books. I believe parents would have exercised more caution and actually reviewed the books before signing a permission slip," Bob Parrish said. He asked the district to standardize the parental consent form, requiring specific details regarding all objectionable content. Over the summer, Higley Unified decided to do just that. Flagging sensitive content, Higley Unified has long had a list of novels approved for teacher use. Before this school year, when a teacher wanted to assign a novel that was not on the list, they would obtain parental permission. Now teachers must stick to the approved novel list. That means that 2 of the 5 books on Boy's list, 19 Minutes and The Perks of Being a Wallflower, can no longer be assigned to students. For novels on the approved list with a sensitive content, sexually explicit content, violence, drug or alcohol use, sensitive content to race and ethnicity, offensive language, or content related to mental health or suicide, the district created a more informalized and thorough permission slip. The slips tell parents what sensitive content the book includes. Students whose guardian chooses not to permit their child to read the suggested novel are given alternate assignments. Previously, the content of permission slips was determined by individual teachers and schools. Because of violence, permission slips are now required for books such as Lord of the Flies by William Golding and Of Mice and Men by John Steinbeck. Animal Farm by George Orwell needs a permission slip because of violence and sensitive content to race and ethnicity. To Kill a Mockingbird by Harper Lee, which is read in the ninth grade, gets a slip for sexually explicit content and violence. Invisible Man by Ralph Ellison, assigned to seniors, needs a slip because of sexually explicit content, sensitive content to race and ethnicity, and violence. Most novels assigned in advanced placement classes, college-level courses that students can take to obtain college credit with an end-of-year exam offered the nonprofit College Board required permission slips. Now, if a teacher wants to introduce a novel into their class that is not already on the approved list, the book must go through a new committee review process. Teachers must plan ahead. The process takes a full school year. The committee, which was formed at the beginning of the school year, identifies sensitive topics in each novel while weighing them against the literary merit of the book. Committee members note how prevalent each of the permission slip's sensitive content areas is in each book. Mary Davis, Higley's Unified Director of Professional Development and leader of the Novel Review Committee, likened it to a rating system. Arizona law requires parental permission for students' exposure to sexually explicit material at school. The remaining sensitive areas identified by the district are an effort to be more transparent with parents, Davis said. For the sensitive content to race and ethnicity, that's just been something that parents have raised concerns about because they just want to know, especially if it has to do with slavery or civil rights, just so that they can start to have those conversations at home and frame it within their family context, she said. Board member Anna Van Hoek asked during a July board meeting if sexuality could be included as one of the areas noted on the permission slip, but the district lawyer advised against it. After the committee votes to approve books suggested by teachers, the public has 60 days to review them and provide feedback before the governing board decides whether to approve them for classroom use. More than 90 people applied over the summer to serve on the Novel Review Committee. It was an overwhelming response, which was really exciting, Davis said. And the district narrowed the pool to 28 members with random withdraw. Half of the committee is made up of district staff, while the other half is made up of parents and community members. This school year, the committee reviewed 17 books requested by teachers. All were approved, and the committee decided permission slips should be required for about half. Over three meetings, committee members noted instances of profanity, alcohol use, smoking, murder, racial discrimination, abuse, or anything else they anticipated might raise concerns about among parents. For The Devil's Highway by Luis Alberto Urrea, requested for an advanced placement 11th grade class, the committee wrote that there were descriptions of medically accurate death in the desert, brief allusions to instances of border patrol groping and raping women, and critiques of Border Patrol, but does also show the other side of that as well. For They Call Us Enemy by George Takei, which was requested for 9th grade students, the committee noted that the book mentioned war, bombing, and protests, and was critical of the American government during World War II, and their involvement in Japanese internment camps. Committee members noted a teenage pregnancy and instances of stalking and children running away in Clap When You Land by Elizabeth Acevedo, An Adulterous Relationship in Big Fish by Daniel Wallace, Colonialism, Racism, and Discussions of Mental Health and Suicide in Mexican Gothic by Sylvia Moreno-Garcia, An Inference of Premarital Sex Relations in the Beantown Girls by Jane Healy, The Creation of a New Religion in Parable of the Sower by Octavia E. Butler. They checked passages against the Arizona statutes requiring parental consent for students' exposure to sexually explicit materials. Those concerns will be presented to the governing board before its members vote on the novels. Although the novel review group resulted from concerns about sensitive content, much of the discussion in committee meetings centered on the book's positive elements and ultimately why they were being recommended for approval. Committee members discussed books' potential for engaging students, their representations of unique perspectives, the valuable lessons they offered, and their literary qualities, focusing on elements like imagery, symbolism, vocabulary, and character development. The governing board will be presented with those positives too. Just because it has violence or any of the sensitive content areas in there doesn't warrant the book to be tossed out, David said. It just means that we are looking at what is in the novel that has that educational value to meet academic standards. Now it's time to flip the pages to the Nation and the World section of the Arizona Daily Star to check out several important articles there. First article is titled GDP Report May Change. This article was written by Josh Bowack of the Associated Press, Dateline West Palm Beach, Florida. Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick said Sunday that government spending could be separated from gross domestic products reports in response to questions about whether the spending cuts pushed by Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency could possibly cause an economic downturn. You know that governments historically have messed with GDP, Lutnick said on Fox News Channel's Sunday Morning Futures. They count government spending as part of GDP, so I'm going to separate those two and make it transparent. Doing so could potentially complicate or distort a fundamental measure of the U.S. economy's health. Government spending is traditionally included in the GDP because changes in taxes, spending, deficits, and regulations by the government can impact the path of overall growth. GDP reports already include extensive details on government spending, offering a level of transparency for economists. Musk's efforts to downsize federal agencies could result in the layoffs of tens of thousands of federal workers whose lost income could potentially reduce their spending, affecting businesses and the economy at large. The Commerce Secretary's remarks echoed Musk's arguments. A more accurate measure of GDP would exclude government spending, Musk wrote in a social media platform. Otherwise, you can scale GDP artificially high by spending money on things that don't make people's lives better. The argument, as articulated so far by Trump's administration officials, appear to play down the economic benefits created by Social Security payments, infrastructure spending, scientific research, and other forms of government spending that can shape an economy's trajectory. If the government buys a tank, that's GDP, Lutnick said Sunday. But paying 1,000 people to think about buying a tank is not GDP. That is wasted inefficiency, wasted money, and cutting that while it shows in GDP, we're going to get rid of that. The Commerce Department's Bureau of Economic Analysis published its most recent GDP report on Thursday, showing that the economy grew at an annual rate of 2.3% in the final 3 months of last year. The report makes it possible to measure the forces driving the economy, showing that the gains at the end of the last year were largely driven by greater consumer spending and an upward revision to federal government spending related to defense. In the GDP report, government spending accounts for almost one-fifth of people's personal income, which totaled more than $24.6 trillion last year. This includes Social Security payments, benefits for military veterans, Medicare and Medicaid, but the report also measures the amount of people's personal income that are paid in taxes. The government is not always a contributor to GDP and can subtract from it, which is what happened in 2022 as pandemic-related aid expired. The next article from the Nation of the World section of the Arizona Daily Star is titled Israel Halts Aid to Gaza Strip. This article was written by Tia Goldenberg and Sammy Magdi of the Associated Press, Tel Aviv, Israel. Israel faced sharp criticism as it stopped the entry of all food and other supplies into Gaza on Sunday and warned of additional consequences for Hamas if a fragile ceasefire isn't extended. Mediators Egypt and Qatar accused Israel of violating humanitarian law by using starvation as a weapon. The ceasefire's first phase saw a surge in humanitarian aid after months of growing hunger. Hamas accused Israel of trying to derail the next phase Sunday, hours after its first phase had ended, and called Israel's decision to cut off aid a war crime and a blatant attack on a truce that took a year of negotiations before taking hold in January. In the second phase, Hamas could release dozens of remaining hostages in return for an Israeli pullout from Gaza and a lasting ceasefire. Negotiations on the second phase were meant to start a month ago, but haven't begun. Israel said Sunday that a new U.S. proposal calls for extending the ceasefire's first phase through Ramadan, the Muslim holy month that began over the weekend, and the Jewish Passover holiday, which ends on April 20th. Under that proposal, Hamas would release half the hostages on the first day, and the rest when the agreement is reached on a permanent ceasefire, Israel Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said. The militants currently hold 59 hostages, 35 of them appear believed to be dead. The U.S. had no immediate comment. Netanyahu said Israel is fully coordinated with the Trump administration and the ceasefire will only continue as long as Hamas keeps releasing hostages. Saying the ceasefire has saved countless lives, the International Committee of the Red Cross said that any unraveling of the forward momentum created over the past 6 weeks risks plunging people back into despair. UN Humanitarian Chief Tom Fletcher called Israel's decision alarming, noting that the international humanitarian law makes clear that aid access must be allowed. Medical charity MSF accused Israel of using aid as a bargaining chip, calling it unacceptable and outrageous. Five non-government groups asked Israel's Supreme Court for an interim order barring the state from preventing aid from entering Gaza, claiming the move violates Israel's obligations under international law. These obligations cannot be conditioned on political considerations. The war has left most of Gaza's population of over 2 million dependent on international aid. About 600 aid trucks had entered daily since the ceasefire began on January 19th, easing fears of famine raised by international experts. But residents said prices shot up as word of the closure spread. From the heavily destroyed Jabalia urban refugee camp, Faiza Nasset said the closure would worsen dire conditions. There will be famine and chaos, she said. Hamas warned that any attempt to delay or cancel the ceasefire agreement would have humanitarian consequences for the hostages. The only way to free them is through the existing deal, the group said. The next article is titled, U.S. Aircraft Carrier Arrives in South Korean Port. This article was written by Hong Jin Kim of the Associated Press, Dateline Seoul, South Korea. A U.S. aircraft carrier arrived in South Korea on Sunday in a show of force, days after North Korea test-launched cruise missiles to demonstrate its counterattack capabilities. The arrival of the USS Carl Vinson and its strike group at the South Korean port of Busan was meant to display a solid U.S.-South Korean military alliance in the face of persistent North Korean threats and boost interoperability of the allies' combined assets, the South Korean Navy said in a statement. It said it was the first U.S. aircraft carrier to travel South Korea since June. The deployment of a carrier is expected to infuriate North Korea, which views temporary deployments of such powerful U.S. military assets as major security threats. North Korea has responded to some of the past deployments of U.S. aircraft carriers, long-range bombers, and nuclear-powered submarines with missile tests. Since his January 20th inauguration, U.S. President Donald Trump has said he will reach out to North Korea leader Kim Jong-un again to revive diplomacy. North Korea hasn't directly responded to Trump's overture, but alleged U.S.-led hostilities against North Korea have intensified since Trump's inauguration. North Korea said Friday it tested Red Strategic Missile cruise missiles earlier this week to inform its adversaries of its military counterattack capability and the readiness of its nuclear operations. The next article is titled, Fired Federal Workers Hunt for New Jobs. This article was written by Matt Sedensky, an AP national writer. Dateline, New York. Hiring. Park Ranger seeking nuclear submarine engineer wanted sled dog musher. If they seem unlikely postings, they probably are, but a laid-off federal worker can dream. Axed from jobs not easily found outside the government, thousands of federal workers caught in President Donald Trump's cost-cutting efforts now face a difficult search for work. If you're doing, say, vegetation sampling and prescribed fire as your main work, there aren't many jobs, said Eric Anderson, 48, of Chicago, who was fired February 14th from his job as a biological science technician at Indiana Dunes National Park. All the years of work Anderson put in, the master's degree, the urban forestry classes, the wildfire deployment, seemed to disappear in a single email dismissing him. He's hoping there's a chance he's called back, but if he isn't, he's not sure what he'll do next. He was so consumed with his firing that he broke a molar from grinding his teeth. But he knows he's caught in something larger than himself as the new administration unfurled its chaotic, cost-cutting agenda. This is someone coming in, tossing a hand grenade, and seeing what will happen, he says. The federal job cuts are the work from the Department of Government Efficiency, headed by billionaire Elon Musk, who has been tearing through agencies looking for suspected waste. No official tally of firings has been released, but their list stretches into the thousands and to nearly every part of the country. More than 80% of the federal government's 2.4 million person civilian workforce is based outside of the Washington area. Cathay Nguyen, 51, of Honolulu, was laid off last month from a job at USAID, where she helped manage the PEPFAR program, which combats HIV/AIDS. Her firing not only brought the turmoil of the firing new health insurance, halting savings for retirements and her kids' college education, and trimming spending for things like family subscription to Disney Plus, it also forced her to reconsider her career goals. PEPFAR is a landmark effort that stretches across dozens of countries and is credited with saving 26 million lives. Nothing rivals it. So where does a former PEPFAR worker go? It's requiring me to rethink how I want to spend my professional life, Nguyen said. As specialized as Nguyen's work has been, Mitch Flanagan may have her beat. Flanagan was assigned to the sled dog kennels at Denali National Park and Preserve in Alaska until he was fired February 14th. It never brought a huge paycheck, but where else could he get to work as a dog musher against such a breathtaking panorama? He has appealed his firing with the U.S. Merit Systems Protection Board. I still kind of want to fight for the job that I lost, he said. I'm not really making much money. It's just fun and it's a unique thing to be part of. A November report from the Federal Salary Council, which advises on government pay, found that federal salaries were one-fourth lower than those in the private sector. A Congressional Budget Office report released last year found pay disparities dependent on workers' education. Federal workers with a high school diploma or less out-earned their private sector counterparts with 17% higher wages, the CBO found. That edge disappeared among better-educated workers. Workers with bachelor's degrees had wages 10% lower than the private sector, and those with professional degrees or doctorates earned 29% less. Federal benefits were vastly better than the private sector for the lowest educated worker, the CBO found, and about even for the highest educated workers. Many laid off from federal positions were drawn by stability, benefits, and more than anything, the opportunity to do work they might not be able to do anywhere else. Now everyone from diplomats to public health workers are flooding the job market looking for suitable positions. Gracie Lynn, a 32-year-old fellow at the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau who lives in Eugene, Oregon, took a pay cut when she started her job 4 years ago. Her parents lost their home during the Great Recession, which led to their divorce, years of financial angst, and Lynn's own interest in financial regulation. She found herself borrowing the nascent CFPB's rulemaking and poring over 1,000-page bills on bank regulations. She wrote her master's thesis on the bureau. She couldn't pass up the job. Now we'll head over to the business section of the Arizona Daily Star for an article, interesting article there. The title of the article is Social Security Administration Could Cut Up to 50% of Its Workforce. This article was written by Fatima Hussein of the Associated Press. Dateline Washington, the Social Security Administration is preparing to lay off at least 7,000 people from its workforce of 60,000, according to a person familiar with the agency's plan who is not authorized to speak publicly. The workforce reduction, according to a second person who spoke on the condition of anonymity, could be as high as 50%. It's unclear how the layoffs will directly impact the benefits of the 72.5 million Social Security beneficiaries, which include retirees and children who receive retirement and disability benefits. However, advocates and Democratic lawmakers warn that layoffs will reduce the agency's ability to serve recipients in a timely manner. Some say cuts to the workforce are in effect a cut in benefits. Later Thursday, the agency sent out a news release outlining plans for significant workforce reductions, employee reassignments from non-mission-critical positions to mission-critical direct service positions, and an offer of voluntary separation agreements. The agency said in its letter to workers that reassignments may be involuntary and may require retraining for new workloads. The layoffs are part of the Trump administration's intensified efforts to shrink the size of the federal workforce through the government, or rather through the Department of Government Efficiency, run by President Donald Trump's advisor Elon Musk. A representative from the Social Security Administration did not respond to a request for comments. The people familiar with the agency's plans say SSA's new acting commissioner, Leland Dudek, held a meeting this week with management and told them they had to produce a plan that eliminated half the workforce at SSA headquarters in Washington and at least half of the workers in regional offices. In addition, the termination of offices leases for Social Security sites across the countries are detailed on the DOGE website, which maintains a wall of receipts. A self-described transparent account of DOGE's findings and actions. The site states that leases for dozens of Social Security sites across Arkansas, Texas, Louisiana, Florida, Kentucky, North Carolina, and other states ended or will be ended. The Social Security Administration is already chronically understaffed. Now, the Trump administration wants to demolish it, said Nancy Altman, president of Social Security Works, an advocacy group for the popular public benefit program. Altman said the reductions in force will deny many Americans access to their hard-earned Social Security benefits. Field offices around the country will close. Wait times for the 1-800 number will soar. Social Security is one of the nation's largest and most popular social programs. A January poll from the Associated Press NORC Center for Public Affairs Research found that two-thirds of U.S. adults think the country is spending too little on Social Security. Due to time constraints, we have reached the end of today's reading of the Arizona Daily Star, the Monday, March 3rd, 2025 edition. For Sun Sounds of Arizona, this is Michael Shannon, your volunteer reader. Thank you very much for listening.